Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
We've got 5 years stuck on my eyes. 5 years, what a surprise. We've got 5 years, my brain hurts a lot.
Hello, Primates! You found Primus Tracks, congratulations! We are at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter. PrimusTracksPod@gmail.com is the email address. You can use that on PayPal, or you can use @PrimusTracks on Venmo to get some wonderful stickers designed by my pal. He's right over there at Primus Tracks Towers. Frankie!
Hi, Josh.
How are you on this fine day?
I'm feeling conspiranoid.
Oh, no.
Again.
Your head must be swimming with all kinds of theories and stories, none of which are supported with facts. Today, Frankie, we will not be trading in conspiracies. We will be talking about history. A lot of conspiracies are rooted in history, but I'm not going to encourage you on that front, okay? I don't think we've done something like this before, where we take a particular chunk of time between official studio releases and just talk about the chunk of time. We're going to be discussing the years 05 to 10, which is how the old guys say it. So I'll say 2005 to 2010 today.
Yes, and I think we haven't done anything like this before, because up until this point, except for, you know, for the hiatus after Antipop, they had been pretty active, you know, and they have been pretty consistent with the cycle of album tour. So during that hiatus, of course, Les was busy, and then Primus came back. But this period of time that we're going to cover, I think, marks the first time that the band was actively touring without new music to support.
They had Animals to semi-promote along with the Seize of Cheese tour or Fromage tour. And then they had those same tracks to play when they did Hallucinogenetics. And then, interestingly, and of course I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but interestingly, some of those tracks fell off the wagon in tours like Beat a Dead Horse, but you could probably tell us more about that.
Oh, so, we'll go into that in a moment.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about Primus Live from 05 to 2008. We're going to talk about the Blame It on the Fish DVD and the Zingers compilation, which is pretty much all that happened in those years until their glorious return in 2010. So we get to end at least on a positive note, and I'm happy about that, Frankie. Because I will say, as an overview, from 05 to 10, that was a tough time for me as a Primus fan. Now, these guys were doing all kinds of stuff, but it wasn't Primus, other than playing a few shows here and there. And that really bummed me out, because that's what got me started, of course. So
if you look at the Primus front, it was really barren. I mean, there are just two lone shows in 2005. But if you look at the full picture, Les was quite busy. He had a ton of fancy band performances in 2005. He also had a lone Holy Mackerel gig.
Right.
He also had some Frog Brigade shows. An Oysterhead reunion was in the horizon. And lest we forget, he had his hands full with Electric Apricot.
That's right. So in that year, Odd Five going into 2006, he was a busy dude. So he had
He was quite busy. And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this period of time when Lur and Brain worked with Serge Tankian?
I believe it was around 7 or 8.
Seven or eight. Oh, yes. I mean, they had to stay busy, right, while Les was doing all of these things.
Yeah, Larry went on tour with Serge. I think that was 7 or 8. I don't know if he worked on that record, but I know he went
on Elect Death, right? That's what they were promoting.
Oh, man.
And I mean, why would Serge pick Lur and Brain particularly? He's got to be a Primus fan, right?
Oh, he's a huge Primus fan, for sure. And System, when they were first coming up, they were one of those bands that Primus or Primus management picked to open for them at a lot of shows in the late 90s, and that helped build that audience for System when they broke and hit it big.
Oh, that's cool.
And I recall on that tour that they played a Dead Kennedys cover as part of their encore. I don't recall if it was Holiday in Cambodia or another one, but if you're going to cover the Dead Kennedys, I got a guitarist for you. You know, so I know Larry took a lead role in that portion of the show, at least. I remember reading.
Apparently, that was 2007.
Okay.
That's when the album came out.
So Larry was doing that, occupying his time in a bunch of different ways. That's probably the most notable. It was so funny when we had him on. I was like, what are you doing in those years? He's like, I don't know, hanging out. And I believed him. To get to Primus in these years, there's not a lot to say. Two shows in '05.
Yeah.
I think they were both fests. There was a festival in 2006, and then we got the final reunion tour, aptly titled and snarkily titled. I don't even know who titled it this. Was it the band? Did they call it the Beat a Dead Horse Tour, or did we put that on that as fans?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's kind of how it felt.
We're venturing into 2006.
Sure.
So I have a few observations about Beat a Dead Horse, and I would like to know what you think, Josh.
Yeah.
From my perspective, this has got to be one of the least exciting Primus tours of all time. I mean, listening to some of these recordings and watching some of the videos, I mean, there were some cool shows for sure, but the overall impression is that they were just going through the motions, right?
Right.
The sets were really safe. They dropped all the fanfare from Hallucinogenetics and from Mosh. I mean, they were playing considerably shorter sets compared to what they were doing on the previous tour. I mean, and it doesn't matter if they were not doing a full album any longer, you know, because they had rehearsed dozens of tracks. I mean, they could have cherry-picked tons of songs to perform, but, you know, they were sticking to this very safe, very repetitive set list. I mean, there were a few odd surprises here and there, you know, the return of Shake Hands with Beef, which was pretty interesting at the time. Hamburger Train also made an appearance. There were some occasional interesting encores, but in general, you know, there's nothing terribly exciting in this set list. And, you know, also being a Primus fan at the time, I recall the excitement when Hallucinogenetics wrapped up. I remember the excitement of thinking that these guys were going to head right back into the studio and they were going to record new material. And at least to me, you know, in my perspective, to replace working in the studio on a new album with embarking on this tour, for me, it was kind of a step back creatively for the band. And I think it kind of shows in the performances. I'm sure their hearts were not 100% on this. And, you know, I don't want to blame anyone, but it is my impression, at least from what I've read over the years, that it came down to Herve not wanting to record new material, right?
You could just blame it on the fish. But by the way, the book, which you haven't mentioned in a while, Over the Electric Grapevine by Greg Prado. What I remember reading is that Les just said the same old issues cropped up. They just weren't seeing eye to eye. The creative flow wasn't there like it had been, of course, in the 90s, but definitely not like it was on the first two tours where they were jamming things out and making new noises. And it just wasn't happening there in '06.
Yeah.
The thing just fell apart again. And they found themselves in a familiar spot and decided to end it, is my understanding.
But do you agree that this tour was kind of a step back for them?
Yeah, I don't recall listening to too many of the recordings, but I do recall tracking the set lists and being somewhat disappointed. Hearing the reviews of the shows, you know, they played their 90 minutes and left. It was kind of a rough time. And I was at a point in my life, too, where I was moving halfway across the United States to start my career. So I was busy at the time. I had my mind on other things. But
yeah.
I think it's fairly obvious. This is our comfort food when it comes to music. And it wasn't there for me. So I had to find other comfort food. I had to switch from my thick, juicy slabs of Primus to something else that, you know, had to fill that void and satisfy me equally, if not more. And so I embarked on this search to find music that did just that. And I, you know, through a patchwork of bands, I think I was able to do that. But it was one of those things where I felt like I was...
What bands filled the void for you back then?
Oh, man, good question. So I think I've talked about it before. Secret Chiefs 3 really did a lot for me. I really enjoyed that band. The talent on display by that group was phenomenal. And I kind of did go down that Mike Patton rabbit hole as well. So I was listening to a lot of Tomahawk, for one. I think those albums are... Those first two especially took the cake for me. Just rediscovering some Zappa and really getting into Beefheart because my dad had talked about Beefheart when I was a younger guy, but I really started getting into them more. So I was trying to find really weird music. I tried out lots of extreme metal of different origins. I bring that up because I have a track to play in a little bit here, and I've got Carcass on this playlist, and I really like Carcass. I don't know what it is, but I really like Carcass. So they were helpful in that time period, too. Still like them a lot. So it was the hodgepodge. I was trying to put that together.
You know, something interesting did happen during Beat a Dead Horse.
You're going to have to tell me.
Les Claypool resurrected a song which just 2 years prior he declared, and I'm going to use his vernacular, just 2 years prior he declared he fucking hated that song. Of course, you know which one, right?
Yeah, it was their least known song.
A surprise return during Beat a Dead Horse.
We're talking
pretty
about
interesting to hear Wynonna again. I mean,
yes. Yes, we are, of course, talking about the Beaver song. I was joking with you or the parrot.
I mean, one has to wonder what happened between 2004 and 2006 to change his perspective so much regarding Wynonna. Because, you know, I mentioned that on some of these shows, it's like they were going through the motions, but the performances of Wynonna are terrific. They were really into it. I mean, they were playing it kind of faster and harder than they do nowadays.
At that point, it's like a new song because you haven't played it with Tim Alexander for 10 years.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It was exciting again, right?
Right, yeah.
And yeah, Wynonna is definitely a standout a song during this particular tour. So right. I would say, you know, I would say Wynonna was something cool that came out of it. The lone performances of Rare tracks like Hamburger Train and Shake Hands with Beef. It was also pretty cool to hear the return of Master of Puppets during Too Many Puppies. And Fort Worth, Texas, Will Rogers Auditorium is a particularly amazing show. The encore is It Luck? So that gives you kind of a perspective about how cool that show is.
Of course,
we cannot forget the instrumental Mary, right? That's also something that happened during this tour.
That's right, the punishment.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. There are a few shows from Beat a Dead Horse that I like to explore every now and then. But I mean, if you compare this tour with the juggernaut that was Fromage and Hallucinogenetics, it just pales by comparison completely. I mean, there's just no comparing the two things.
It was definitely a tough pill to swallow after the excitement of Fromage and Hallucinogenetics. And to me, you know, that Halluciné DVD came out. I mean, that had its own issues. They're standard Primus ones. Poor lighting, of course.
Yeah,
but, sure. But it was released at an interesting time in technological history, I suppose. They filmed it with a 4:3 ratio in standard definition, right as the switch to 16:9 high definition is starting to take shape. So it was one of those things where you get this DVD. It was at that weird time where you could tell you were watching TV as opposed to a movie. It was a little disappointing in that regard, but it was still quite satisfying.
I just wanted to point out before it slips my mind that Boston 2006 is also a pretty great show. There's a really great recording available. I particularly like it because it includes Mr. Know-It-All and Zajig, which was kind of a rarity during 2003 and 2004. It includes Nature Boy, which is always a treat live.
Oh, yeah.
It closes with Wynonna, which is great, but it's particularly funny to listen to Jerry Was a Race Car Driver because Les opens the song by telling the audience, "Put your dancing shoes on."
Well, it's good that there are some gems hidden in there.
Cool stuff here and there. I mean, it's not totally worthless. I mean, there's cool stuff to explore there, but like we have agreed on, it was pretty much a step back from where they were building up to creatively and cohesively as a trio of musicians.
Yeah.
I do recall a particular show which I watched on video where you can see that, you know, they had this kind of interesting stage setup going. Do you recall how Curve was surrounded by some kind of glass panel? Yeah, and that's not something that they were doing up until that point, right?
Don't recall, but I know that he was mic'd because he was doing some backup vocals throughout those tours, so I wonder if that was part of it so that his mic wasn't picking up all kinds of noise.
I I remember also a particular recording where you can see, I mean, it's pretty much the only time I've ever seen something like that. You can see Lur throwing kind of a tantrum on stage.
Well,
he throws his guitar into the air and he storms off the stage really pissed. Oh, and I've always wondered what happened on that particular show that pissed Larry off so much. Because, you know, I cannot recall him doing something like that before or since.
Yeah. Oh, we all have bad days. So after Dead Horse wraps up, that's pretty much it for Primus. Performing live, doing any hope of a studio recording. Because in 2007, there were absolutely zero live performances.
Yeah, Les had his hands completely full with Fancy. I mean, he was really behind that record. Promotion wise, you know, he was touring a lot. He was also promoting a book. I mean, he had like he likes to say, right? He had multiple pots on the stove at the same time, and clearly Primus was not in the cards. And it's understandable in the context, right? Because Beat a Dead Horse probably was not that satisfying for him creatively to crave Primus. I mean, compared to the other options that he had at the moment, which was playing exciting music for him, which was Fancy, which is what that band was catering to at the moment in the creative aspect. We do have to discuss Zingers before we wrap up with the 2006 period, because it's pretty much what Primus had to promote during that year, right?
Right, so Zingers and Blame It on the Fish were released on the same day.
That's right. So let's start with Zingers, and then we can discuss Fish, right?
Sure.
So let's talk about the good and the bad regarding Zingers. Let's start with the positive things. I think the packaging is brilliant.
Right, we talked to Ruben Root about the packaging and how...
Yeah, it's so cynical, such a sarcastic packaging. I just love it.
Right,
I'm not referring particularly to the fact that it's presented as if it were cheese. I'm talking about, you know, this text that says classic Primus songs repackaged for your listening convenience and our financial benefit. That is just hilarious.
Yes, because they knew what it was exactly, and they weren't going to hide it. I think at that point, their relationship with Interscope was essentially over with. I'm sure they had fulfilled their contract and whatever.
Yes.
But and I do remember Les saying in the book that Lefkowitz suggested a greatest hits at that time. Les went with it because he knew, I think, that all those Primus dudes needed the money. Because, as you said before, Les was making Electric Apricot. Can't recall if he was financing that himself, but, I mean, he makes everything on the cheap anyway. But when you take that much time to create a film, you're not doing other things, and therefore even he was hurting for cash. We'll definitely get into that project in later episodes. But Les does say, yeah, we did it in this self-destructive way. I was being really sarcastic with the cheese thing. But then Zoltron and Ruben Rude went with it as far as the packaging went. And it is. It's brilliant packaging.
Didn't Les say that they would agree to releasing a greatest hits package as long as they had complete creative control over the packaging?
Because this never would have flown if they hadn't made that deal. Because as Ruben told us, you know, wouldn't it be great if you tear the wrapper off and all that's left is the cheese? So all that beautiful artwork is gone. You ripped it open. I will say, I don't know. Did you buy one when it was released, Frankie? I did not.
Oh, yes. I have three different versions of this album. Okay. I have a version that comes with wrapping that is kind of like cellophane surrounding the jewel case. So you got to tear it open pretty carefully if you want to preserve the artwork.
Right.
And I have another version, which is a slipcase with the same design. So you preserve the same artwork, but it's much easier to take the CD out. And my pride and joy that took me a while to track down is a 2-CD version that was a Target exclusive, I believe.
In the United States, it was a Best Buy exclusive. But
oh, Best
it
Buy,
been
yeah, sorry.
Elsewhere.
Best Buy, sorry. Okay. Best Buy exclusive. And this one comes with a second disc called Extra Cheese, which features four performances from Woodstock 94.
Right.
So it took me a while to track this one down, and I really like it.
Were those Woodstock performances gussied up at all, or does it just sound like a straight soundboard?
Nah, it sounds exactly like the video.
So nothing...
But it's nice to have, you know? It's cool to have something which was kind of exclusive. Another thing that I want to point out that is really great about Zingers is the mastering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking about the brick walling and the loudness war on the CDs, I know that a lot of people probably do not enjoy the way this album sounds. But, you know, for me, at least for me, loud is always better. So something that really frustrated me about Seas of Cheese is how quiet it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really had to turn off the volume on my devices to enjoy it. And this compilation, you know, presented all of these tracks in the same way, you know, volume wise.
Right.
So there was no need to modify anything. And Jerry sounds particularly fantastic on this release. I mean, if I think about original Seas of Cheese 2013 and Zingers, for me, Zingers is the definite winner. I love listening to Jerry and Tommy the Cat on this release because of the way that they are mixed.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a pretty good, pretty strong song selection. I mean, we have discussed about the inclusion of Coattails of a Dead Man. Of course, we cannot forget the amazing version of Shake Hands with Beef, which has the actual ending of the track instead of the fade out that we have on the Brown album. So all of those little details here and there were pretty nice surprises to discover the first time that I was listening to the album. And, you know, and to this day, Shake Hands with Beef, Tommy the Cat, and Jerry, I mean, my go-to tracks when I want to listen to the studio versions are the Zingers versions, mm-hmm. for sure.
Well, they had to do that because this spans, what, 5, 6, 7 releases.
Yeah.
So they had to remaster it to align all the volumes so that there wasn't that variance between tracks. So, yeah, the Cheese tracks had to be turned up more than I imagine to line them up with the rest of them. So that would be pretty satisfying as far as getting the volume that you crave without getting distortion and so on. So,
but besides the volume boost, I think there was definitely more tweaking going on because... If you compare the heavy part of Jerry on Zingers versus the original Seas of Cheese, it sounds totally different.
Oh, okay. Well, I will say I did buy a Zingers compilation in 2021 for super cheap, but I have not yet opened it.
So wow.
Maybe that's the impetus for opening
it. Yeah, that's something pending.
I'll be right back. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah. The bath. I mean, we got to mention the downside of this release. I mean, we have discussed how cool it is in terms of presentation, song selection, and mastering. But I mean, going back to what we were discussing regarding Beat a Dead Horse, it's kind of a step back, right? I mean, this release prompted the tour, which in and on itself was one of the least exciting periods in Primus history.
So, you know, well, that's what a greatest hits compilation does. It rehashes what's already there, and that's what Beat a Dead Horse did. And you know, I remember reading in the book, these guys were saying, we don't want to become a nostalgia band, and that's kind of what they were treading on at that point.
Yeah.
And it was something they didn't want. You know, they quit before it got even worse, much like back in at the turn of the century. So at least they know when to stop before it turns into something they absolutely did not want it to be. They could have been playing state fairs after that.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that, you know where you are.
Let's discuss Fish. Again, from a design perspective, it's a hilarious presentation, right? I love the way that it's packaged with the fish scales. It's really clever.
Right, yeah, it's pretty cool. But much like the Zingers, it's a bit of a bare bones release. You know, there's some copy on there to talk us through it, but the selection menus are so basic. And I know it was 2006, but you know, it's even in 2006.
But it features unreleased music.
This is true. But the, you know, just the presentation of it's kind of basic. And then I know it's packaged as an abstract look. And indeed, it's an abstract look. It's scattered, but I guess I wanted a narrative, even though I went in knowing I wasn't going to get one, if that makes any sense. But there are enough, I will say there's enough bonus material to satiate the hardcore fans such as myself. We get the full Primus 2063, which is really funny and actually introspective. We also get the extra stuff, you know, the extra hour of footage that they just tossed on there. So there is a lot of good stuff on there.
Yes. We have that really funny feature of Primus in the future, right?
That's the Primus 2063 or 65 with less dressed up as
Primus
an old man.
2065.
That's the one. Yeah.
It's great. It's a great piece of work.
Yeah. He does say something profound in that, too. We know he doesn't speak in superlatives. He said this 1,000 times. I don't like to talk about favorites. I don't like to talk about the best. And he says something as the 102-year-old Les Claypool. I remember him saying, "We didn't bring the best out of each other. We brought the Primus out of each other." And that's, to me, that stuck with me. And he said that before, not as a 102-year-old man caked in makeup. But he's right, because he's played with so many people. It's probably impossible to say who brings the best out of him, but he does know that these are the three guys that really make Primus, even though there have been other drummers in and out and in and out.
He did say so in an interview promoting Animals Should Not Try to Act Like People. He said, "I don't make music like this with anybody else."
Exactly. And that was
totally true.
That was a recurring theme, and I think that showed up on the in the Blame It on the Fish as well. So we did get some nice backstage footage. We got some of those promo footages. We got some of the promo footage when they're on things like Rockline or talking to guys in front of a camera. And just being themselves, you know, being goofy. But this came out in 06, and so it was enough to tide me over. I really enjoyed watching it more than once.
I have watched it perhaps 3 times in my life in total. I find it kind of a frustrating release, to be honest, because I really enjoy the performances in the DVD. You know, for example, when they're playing Mr. Crinkle and you get all these really cool shots of Les with the pig mask on, or bits and bobs here and there of, you know, different songs. It's really enjoyable, but, you know, I understand creatively where they were coming from, where, like, with this psychedelic abstract approach at the tour. But it's just one of those things that, at least for me, it's not enjoyable to watch repeatedly. It's,
right.
You know, it's a curiosity. I mean, the first time you watch it, it's pretty interesting. But for me, it's frustrating because I would have loved to have full performances, for instance. So in my ideal version of Primus history, it would have been really great if Hallucinogenetics had been released to represent that portion of the tour, and if they had released Blame It on the Fish separately as a representation of Tour de Fromage, it would have been really cool to get a full Fromage performance in the same way that we got Hallucinogenetics, of course, including songs that we did not get in the other release. For example, it would have been really fantastic to get a full video performance of songs like Carpenter.
Oh, sure.
So it would have been great, you know, if they had done the full concert, and then maybe, you know, as a bonus feature, you know, this trippy footage or these, you know, these trippy sequences, and, you know, also tag on the Primus 2065 thing. You know, it would have been great, like, just to have the option to watch the film as it is or watch a full performance. At least for me, that would have been really great.
Let's empty the vault. Let's go. Let's go find the stuff. Let's put it together.
Let's go find a Fromage show. Yeah.
Put it on, and we'll put it on that Caesar Cheese box set that you created in 2 seconds the other.
Oh, yeah. That would have been really fantastic.
Yeah. It's no longer a box. It's now a trunk. It's humongous.
Yeah. And let's not forget the reason why Blame It on the Fish was titled such way.
Oh, if I recall correctly, on one of their tour stops, didn't Herb choose to eat some fish for dinner and it made him sick?
Right on. He got food poisoning from bad fish in a restaurant. And
that's right.
It's really, you know, it's really admirable how he went out to perform such complex, demanding music while experiencing food poisoning. That's a true testament to his professionalism.
Just like Jordan in the finals with the flu, right?
Yeah, or Les tackling Davis with his voice completely shot.
My God. All three of them, heroes. Yeah, one last thought on Blame It on the Fish. Remember when they were on Rockline and they're sitting there with the microphones in front of them and they're spaced out in the studio?
Yes.
Somebody called in and said, "Hey, you guys reformed. You're doing this tour. Is anything going to come from this as far as studio recordings?" And there was dead silence. Not one of those three guys could come up with a answer quickly. Crickets. And then Larry gave one of his standard non-committal answers. We don't think 10 minutes ahead of ourselves, which is fairly accurate, actually. But it was prescient considering what was to come. Nothing happened. They did a greatest hits. You know, they did the abstract DVD. In retrospect, that moment gives me goosebumps in a bad way. But
oh,
I will
yeah,
say,
definitely.
I think, yeah, I will say one of the, my favorite things about this release is that it gives us more footage of them in the desert running around in costume, which is delightful.
That
and,
footage should have been used for a Rapscallion music video.
Oh my gosh, yes. It gave us what amounts to an unreleased Primus track, which I think you were referencing earlier. So
the circus track.
Somebody was kind enough to stitch together a couple of the jams from this DVD that were recorded, and we have...
Yeah, and I got that from you.
And oh, that's right. You got it from me. Yeah. And I was so kind as to share it with Frankie, but this is what amounts to an unreleased 4-minute Primus song, or essentially a demo. Let's listen to part of it, shall we? And we get some cool loop in here, too. It is pretty cool. And eventually, Tim starts going in double time. We get more Larry. We get more Les. It's a pretty cool sound and jam there. Sounds great,
like soundcheck stuff, for sure.
Definitely. Sounds great. Those are some of those jams that will never see the light of day. And, you know, if they had got into the studio, sounds like they might have come up with some good stuff. But you can't force it.
So 2007 was a vacant year. And then we arrived to 2008, where... Once again, they found themselves with no new music to support, and they just performed 4 concerts at 4 different festivals during 2008, of which Outside Lands in San Francisco stands out in particular because we have pro shot footage of this concert.
Right.
And, you know, even though it's a completely safe set list, it's an excellent show. Mr. Know-It-All is particularly fantastic on this on this pro-shot video, because you get some close-up action of Les doing the aggressive part of the track.
And this one was streamed. I remember what
this one was streamed. Yeah, and Tim had the huge white Tamakit, which is now legendary.
Right. Yeah, that was a nice show. And if I recall, almost every single track is either from Frizzle or Seize.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
So they definitely, because they probably rehearsed for 5 minutes leading up to that, because it's just 4 festival dates spread over that summer, and they're once again all doing something else. And this is about that time I remember Les was quoted as saying, Primus only comes out of hibernation if there's a big tasty salmon dangled in front of us, or words to that effect. Which, by the way, is code for money. They only took those big festival dates at that time. So. Man, once again, going through the motions, doing it for the money, not really promoting anything, but people are still going to see them. But at the same time, they're playing a festival set. So
sure. And you know, I mean, if you follow Les as an artist and you tag along with whatever project he's currently doing, I mean, it was an exciting time. But if you are one of those people that say, I only care about Primus, this was a time of uncertainty, right? At that point, it had been 5 years without new music. The odd concerts here and there, you know, so one has to wonder, you know, are they going to keep going this way? Is Les going to continue focusing his energy on side projects and maintain Primus as a festival act? Or are they going to completely disband again. It was a pretty uncertain time, but things turned around, Josh, after another vacant year, which was 2009. Not for Les, of course, but for Primus.
Yeah. I will say in 2009, I was convinced that Primus was dead. And yeah. I was sad. And that actually between 2004 and 2009, my only, you know, Primus or Les related live experience was the Fungi band came through town 10 minutes from my house in '09. So I went and saw it. I was given a glimmer of hope because they played a whole three or four Primus songs that night.
Southbound Pachyderm for sure, right?
Pachyderm, Fisticuffs are the two I remember. I think he teased Crinkle, and I thought, well, at least those are still in his head to a degree. But I was still convinced that 2009, all right, this is the world in which we live. I don't know if it's worth it.
I had the same feeling. I thought Primus was done, and Les would focus on solo projects. But because of that, I was kind of out of the loop with news concerning Les and Primus. I mean, every now and then I would just check up what was new and, you know, if there was a new album in the horizon, a new Les album, you know, I would say, oh, I'm gonna buy that when it comes out. But nothing terribly exciting. But I do remember, just out of curiosity, checking the official Primus website one afternoon, and I was completely surprised to see this animation of an elevator and the text that said, Primus will be with you shortly. I couldn't believe it.
Yes.
I thought, what is going on? What's happening?
Yeah. I cannot share how excited I was when I was either notified of that and went and saw it myself, or just like you, just went to check it out one day to see what was going on, if anything. And all of a sudden, there was that animation, Primus will be with you shortly. No way. You know, so something was happening, and we didn't know what, but it was delightful to see. It was shocking to see.
It was shocking. And then the cat was out of the bag, and we knew Primus was coming back, and they were doing it with Jay Lane on drums.
So the story goes, and Frankie, please correct me if I'm wrong, I think Larry was pushing for it throughout 2009 and into 2010, and Les said, all right. So I believe they actually contacted Tim, who wasn't
into it. He was not interested.
Yeah, and Les said, the only other drummer I'm going to do this with is Jay Lane. And actually, Jay's story about it is really great. So go out and buy Greg Prado's book. I'm not going to retell this story, but Jay's story about it is really great. And he said, yeah, I'm in. So that is in 2010 where we're going to leave off. Jay Lane has joined Primus, Les, Lur, and Jay, and they've started to make music together.
Yeah.
Man.
I mean, we're not going to retell Jay's story, but I want to point out that from my perspective, I got into Primus when Herf was in the band. So in my mind, it was Les, Lur, and Herf.
Right.
And going back to discover the catalog of the band, you know, I did enjoy Brain's contributions. But by the time they announced the return, it was strange because, of course, I was excited that Primus was coming back. But at the same time, a part of me was hesitant because I was like, oh, my God, another drummer? Are they changing drummers again? And for some odd reason, Jay was not kind of in my mind regarding Sausage or early Primus. You know, my point of reference for Jay as a musician was the three guys named Schmo performance.
Ah.
Yeah, from the 5 gallons of diesel DVD. So
right.
In my mind, I was like, is that guy going to play the Primus songs, really? But as soon as I heard the June rehearsal extended play, all my concerns were laid to rest. You know, I thought, wow, this sounds really cool. It's totally different to Herf, for sure, but in a good way. It's exciting and it's fresh. And
yeah.
I do enjoy revisiting that EP very often because just the sound that they achieved for that release is really fantastic.
You know, we didn't even discuss doing an episode on that, did we? We should do a whole episode on that 2010 EP. What are we thinking?
Yeah, we should save the 2010 EP for later, but I just want to point out that Me Llamo Moth was such a cool surprise.
Good old Me Llamo Mud, man.
Yeah,
they were, and that's the thing. We're not gonna get too much into those recordings now because I think we'll talk about them next episode. But just going back through that book everybody said essentially the same thing about Jay Alain. He brought this energy, and everybody knew it and could feel it and could see it. And, you know, Les relates that moment. We went into Pudding Time on our first rehearsal slash jam. I looked over at Lur, and he had a huge smile on his face, and I had a huge grin on my face, and we knew. You know, they knew it within 20 seconds that this was the right thing to do. So, I mean, for those guys, it was that moment. But for us, it was seeing that animation of the elevator on the website and going, they're back. They're going to do it this time. So,
and that that excitement, you know, was reflected in the set lists. I mean, it was so refreshing to see rare songs coming back into the set, deep cuts, new approaches to tracks they had been performing for a long time. And I mean, if we just go over some statistics to point out some special things during the 2010 tour.
Starting with a secret show at the Great American Music Hall that, what a night that would have been.
I mean, from these 2010 performances, I mean, we have Over the Falls, which right now sounds like nothing special at all, but back then it was like, oh my God, they're doing Over the Falls and
there
they're
was
extending
a time.
It. Yeah, and they're doing a solo in the middle. It was so new at the time.
That's right.
Drum solos were back. You know,
yeah.
The really, really amazing Jay Alain touch. Pudding Time was particularly great during this tour as well.
Yeah.
We also got Golden Boy, which was so amazing to hear live again.
I think it was all that Brown Album material that really excited a lot of people.
Yeah, the Brown Album coming back was really, really unexpected. Behind My Camel, I mean, who would expect them to perform a song from Rhinoplasty during a reunion tour? It was just surreal. They also enjoyed doing Big in Japan during this tour, if you recall.
Oh, I do recall, because I was there when they played Big in Japan one of those nights.
Full Sappington Willoughby outside of the context of a full Frisco Fry performance is also something pretty unique.
That's right. Yeah, they were reaching deep into the bag of tricks as far as tracks go. Duchess became a mainstay.
Became a mainstay. Kalamazoo. I mean, Jesus Christ, Kalamazoo made it into the sets. Mrs. Blaylin, which hadn't been heard since the Hallucinogenetics tour, full performances of In the Flesh.
Right. Yeah, my understanding is that Jay just went ham and rehearsed all of these songs and said, let's keep going. Let's go deep. If we're going to do it, let's go deep. And
Coattails of a Dead Man.
That's the one I get to hang my hat on.
Yeah, and Zjig, a lone performance of Robot Chicken. Shake Hands with Beef was also played once. We also got Southington Waltz once. I can't believe it. I think they did perform Seas of Cheese in its entirety once in 2010. So that's why we have these lone performances of tracks like Southington Waltz, Los Bastardos. Yeah, they did perform The Last Salmon Man. So that, I mean, let's focus on that for a moment. They came back. They had a new drummer. They were dusting off the deep cuts. And they, you know, considering all of these things, they found the time to write new material. And they were performing a new song during this time. It's just mind-blowing.
It was a creatively fertile period. So that Jay energy that I mentioned was fueling it, taking him into overdrive. And it was really great to see. And here.
And the first Primus New Year's Eve in quite a while, right?
That's right. So it really portended to great things when they came back in 2010 and went on this pretty extensive tour, but were also already putting together material for a new record. We won't get to that new record for a couple episodes here, but I'm really excited because we're going to get into that Jay Alain era, which holds a special place in my heart.
Let's just talk about the Fox Theater in Oakland, the day prior to New Year's Eve, December 30th. I mean, they performed Seas of Cheese in its entirety as the main set. You know, there was nothing prior to it.
Mm-hmm.
For the encore, they busted out The Last Salmon Man, Harold of the Rocks, but the residents opened the show.
That's right. Big time. all these things are coming back together. That year essentially ends with the Residents opening for them on New Year's Eve.
And
then on New Year's Eve, pretty much all of Les's friends are in attendance for the Fancy Brigade opening the show for Primus, and
that's right.
All kinds of great stuff going on. So the world was all right again on New Year's.
It was
Eve.
Pretty exciting because the following day for New Year's Eve, Les did his one-off Fancy Brigade, and they performed Amanita's Up on the Roof, Precipitation, Boombill Stomp, Hendershot, Cosmic Highway, and D's Diner with a unique configuration of musicians.
Yeah, so they pretty much did every Les solo project.
it's really crazy to ponder, you know, after being kind of dormant for the previous 5 years, just doing festivals, doing one-offs, playing greatest hits. I mean, the year they came back, they did not slowly build up. I mean, they went full out from the get-go.
And they wouldn't slow down going into 2011, 12, and 13. And that's what I'm most looking forward to, is talking about those years and the recordings that resulted from them. I'm so glad ended on a positive note, Frankie. I was down in the dumps for about 3/4 of this.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to wrap up and to know what you think, Josh, from my perspective, these 5 years were pretty informative for Les. If you look at the big picture, he was doing tons of things. You know, he was finding inspiration and artistic expression in a lot of different outlets, except for Primus.
Right.
They kind of, you know, they treated the band during that period of time, as you described it, you know, just like a vehicle to make money with one-offs. But despite the multiple things that could have happened, you know, the band completely breaking up for good, or the band continuing down that path of playing festival dates with the same old set list.
Yeah.
I mean, those two scenarios are terrifying, right? I cannot choose one to be better than the other. Both are absolutely dreadful.
Right.
Instead, you know, they rose from the ashes with this incredibly renewed and reinvented version of Primus, with a new drummer, fresh set lists, deep cuts. They were making the music. They had a new sound. Les was, you know, really, really inspired to do Primus again. And I'm just thankful that Jay was there to tackle, you know, this job, because, I mean, if Curve had said no and then Jay had not been available, I don't know if they would have searched for another option, or if that would have been the final nail in the coffin.
Right. Everything. So, yeah.
Thank goodness for Jay, you know, to embark on this adventure, which we're going to discuss in depth later. So that's my perspective of these 5 years. What do you think, Josh?
I would first like to say, bless you, Jay Lane. But for Primus, we had two DVDs, a greatest hits package, a pretty big tour to support it, but that only gave the illusion that Primus was truly active in these years. Les's heart and mind were obviously elsewhere. Electric Apricot movie and soundtrack. He wrote a book. He had a couple solo records and DVDs in there as well. Worked with Gabby Lala on her record. But, you know, collaborating with people all over the place and turning up on a lot of studio recordings. So it'd be a misnomer, I suppose, to call it a fallow period for Les Claypool or Tim Alexander, who was making a bunch of records in this time period too. But it was definitely that for Primus. So it was rough, but then we got to 2010. I'm really looking forward. First of all, I'm glad that's now in the rear view for our retrospective, and now we can get into the fun stuff again. Here's to Les, Lur, and Jay getting into 2010 and 2011.
Cheers.
Later days.
Willie Mays.